Good afternoon, and welcome to the first broadcast of the 2008 season of Fireside Chats of the Securities and Exchange Commission Historical Society on www.sechistorical.org. I'm Teresa Gabaldon, Lyle T. Alverson Professor of Law at the George Washington University School of Law and moderator of the Fireside Chats. As our listeners may know, the SEC Historical Society preserves and shares the history of the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission and of the securities industry through its virtual museum and archive at www.sechistorical.org. The museum's collections are free and accessible worldwide at all times. The virtual museum and archive, as well as the Society, are separate from and independent of the SEC and receive no government funding. Our program today marks the start of the fifth anniversary broadcast season of the Fireside Chats. The chats were launched by the Society in 2004 with moderator Donald Langevoort of Georgetown University Law School to help mark the 70th anniversary of the founding of the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. Today's Fireside Chat is part of the Society's commemoration of the upcoming 75th anniversary of the SEC in 2009. From now through next May, we'll focus our discussions on the distinctive history and work of many of the major SEC divisions and offices. Our Fireside Chat today looks at the SEC Office of the General Counsel. I'm delighted to welcome two former general counsels, Daniel Gelser, a member of the board of the Public Company Accounting Oversight Board, and Giovanni Prezioso, a partner with Cleary Gottlieb Steen & Hamilton, LLP. Their remarks today are solely their own and are not representative of the opinions of the Society. Our speakers cannot give legal or investment advice. We thank Pfizer, Inc. for its continuing generous sponsorship of the entire 2008 Fireside Chat season. Its support, along with gifts and grants from many other institutions and individuals, make possible the growth and outreach of the virtual museum and archive. Of particular importance, our chat today is in remembrance of Eric Sommergrad, a former deputy solicitor of the Office of the General Counsel, who died last September. Eric's service at the SEC since 1984 is a testament to the quality and dedication of the many SEC staff members who have worked and continue to work on behalf of U.S. and international investors since 1934. I'd like to take a moment before we begin our discussion to highlight a few of the many significant milestones in Eric's career. He was a graduate of Oberlin College with highest honors in government and earned a law degree from New York University Law School, where he was research editor of the Law Review. Prior to joining the SEC in 1984, he was with Arnold & Porter, LLP. Once joining the commission, he rose quickly within the Office of the General Counsel, serving successively as special counsel in the appellate group, senior special counsel, assistant principal general counsel, Principal Assistant General Counsel, and finally as Deputy Solicitor beginning in 1998. Eric was recognized as the 1989 Younger Federal Lawyer by the Federal Bar Association in Washington. In 1995, Eric was given the SEC's Philip A. Loomis Jr. Award, presented to, I quote, "the individual who displays the qualities of outstanding legal scholarship, analysis, and draftsmanship, the legal counselor's ability to reconcile opposing viewpoints and create workable solutions to difficult legal and policy issues, and the highest caliber of personal and professional integrity." Dan, I know that you received the same award a decade prior to Eric's recognition. Philip Loomis was a former general counsel and commissioner who had a distinguished career of 28 years at the SEC. I'd now like to read from a letter sent to Eric in 1997 by Milton V. Freeman, one of the giants of securities laws, who had served at the SEC in its earliest days. Mr. Freeman was congratulating Eric on his successful argument on behalf of the SEC in U.S. versus O'Hagan, one of the key insider trading cases. As Mr. Freeman wrote, "You have won the O'Hagan case. I hold you exclusively responsible for this great victory by the Commission. I hope never to find myself in a position where I have to face your formidable talents in opposition again." Dan and Giovanni, would you like to share any of your memories of working with Eric?
Sure. Yeah, thanks, Teresa. As you've noted, Eric joined the office in 1984, and I think we realized pretty rapidly that we had an appellate litigation star on our hands. He really had the main hand in many of the significant securities law developments in the appellate courts over the years he was in the general counsel's office. What when I think back of those time of those times, I think of Eric's role in our amicus program, particularly. He was the principal author of the commission's amicus brief in Basic versus Levinson, which is one of the landmark cases on the law of materiality. He was responsible in those days for a series of briefs we were filing about the relationship between state and federal takeover laws and trying to make sure that state law couldn't interfere unduly with federal tender offer regulation. Another brief that comes to mind was one we filed in the contest between Pennzoil and Texaco over the attempt to take over Getty Oil. And the day that that brief was filed, the market and the two stocks moved a combined total of $1 billion, which we thought was a pretty good accomplishment for a government lawyer writing an amicus brief. On a personal level, Eric was just a wonderful guy to work with. I know it's kind of a cliche to say that a lawyer has an encyclopedic knowledge of the law, but I would still say that about Eric. He was also a great teacher and mentor to the folks that he worked with. Another thing that I recall about him is he was a devoted uncle to, I believe, his brother's children, and was always happy to pull out photos and show you how they were doing and developing. The last thing I note about Eric was he has a distinction that no other lawyer at the SEC has. He was the only person on the winning side in the Dirks case because he was at Arnold and Porter representing Dirks at the time that we lost that litigation. But again, he's really one of the mainstays of the office. He'll be very missed.
Giovanni?
He really was a fantastic colleague during my tenure at the commission. I mentioned two things that come to mind. First, when I first arrived at the commission, one of the first experiences I had with Eric was getting a brief late on a Saturday night. He was just an indefatigable worker. And I thought, this is great. This fellow's a hard worker. He sent me a brief at 11 on a Saturday night. And in the morning when I woke up, at whatever time I woke up, I saw he had done a whole new draft of the brief and had sent it out a few hours later. I said, this is really a work ethic I'm not sure I can keep up with. The second thing that comes to mind is that towards the end of the time that I was at the commission, there was a very interesting case in which the NASD, for the first time in the history of the commission's oversight of its sanctions, challenged the commission's decision overturning its sanctions. It was a case of first impression that was very important to the programs of the commission. And there were some very tricky legal issues. Eric did his usual masterful job on the brief, developing some theories in the absence of any kind of clear precedent really dealing with these issues. And he did such a good job that I prevailed upon him to argue the case at the D.C. Circuit. And I think, you know, though he did that with some trepidation because it was there was a lot of downside. It's a difficult case. He was facing some health challenges. But as always, he stepped right up. And not only did he do a great job at the oral argument, I still remember very vividly sort of his face when he came with the news that, you know, the opinion had been very favorable, even more favorable, so favorable I think it surprised even him. And he was just delighted, and as you can imagine, I was delighted for the commission and for him. He was just a great colleague and took on some wonderful challenges and worked very hard for all of the folks at the commission to get that mission done.
Thank you for sharing your thoughts. It is a privilege to remember Eric Summergrad as we begin this chat about the SEC Office of the General Counsel. We thank his family for making a generous gift to help sponsor this chat and for contributing materials from and about Eric for inclusion in the collections of the Virtual Museum. I encourage our listeners to access these materials after today's broadcast. Turning, though, now to a more general discussion of the Office of the General Counsel, I would appreciate it if one of you could give us a little bit of background about the office. For instance, did it come into existence at the same time as the commission itself or sometime later?
Well, while I was at the commission somewhat before Giovanni was, I'm afraid even my memory doesn't extend back to 1934, so I had to look it up. In Joel Seligman's book, The Transformation of Wall Street, he describes the appointment of the first general counsel, who was John Burns. And at least according to the version there was some horse trading among the commissioners about who would be responsible for which staff appointments. Joe Kennedy reserved for himself the appointment of the general counsel and appointed John Burns, who was a young judge in the state of Massachusetts. He'd been, at the age of 29, he'd been a professor at the Harvard Law School, so he was apparently quite a hot shot in the legal field. The difficulty was that Commissioner Landis felt that Ben Cohn, one of the drafters of the securities laws, ought to be the general counsel. And so Kennedy, in order to avoid dissension on the commission, said, well, we'll have two general counsels. Cohn and Burns can both be general counsel. Felix Frankfurter, who was apparently pulling the strings on a lot of these things from the Harvard faculty up in Cambridge, persuaded Landis that it wouldn't be a good idea to have two general counsels, and so Landis withdrew his insistence on Cohn, and Burns became the first general counsel. What the office was like in those days, I'm afraid I wasn't able to discover. I mentioned it had a very small staff.
Do all federal agencies have something more or less equivalent to a general counsel's office?
I guess my answer would be, as far as I know, and it seems to me, sort of given the nature of Washington and federal agencies, it's almost essential to have some sort of legal staff of advising you about the agency's compliance with the law. It seems to me that the thing that distinguishes the SEC's general counsel's office is the broad range of its responsibilities, which I think has traditionally been close to the maximum that a federal agency's legal staff can have, in that they represent the agency in the appellate courts, free of the Justice Department's control, traditionally argued their own cases in the Supreme Court with only minimal supervision from the Solicitor General's office, able to take positions on legislation, again, free of any control of the administration, along with the regular host of internal legal advisory tasks that any general counsel's office would perform.
I think that the closest similarities will be in the general counsel's offices of the other independent agencies. If you look to places like the Federal Trade Commission, which has obviously a common ancestry in a sense with the SEC, the CFTC, the issues that the general counsel's offices of those independent agencies face often overlap, and indeed sometimes on issues that are common to independent agencies, the general counsels of the different agencies will speak to each other or even informally meet over lunch to discuss matters such as how to administer the Sunshine Act in a multi-member agency and other issues that pretty much no other legal office on the planet would care about.
It sounds like there's a lot of work to be done. What size of an office are we talking about to provide the person power here?
Well, I don't know exactly what the headcount is today. I would suspect it's in the neighborhood of 120 people all in. I guess I can say that when I joined the office on September 1st, 1974, it had 35 people in it, again, all secretaries, lawyers, all included. I believe when I left in 1990, the total was in the high 90s, 96 or something in that neighborhood. So that's sort of the range of the staffing. I mean, maybe it's a point to make that perhaps unlike at some other agencies, nothing like all the lawyers at the SEC are in the general counsel's office. The agency is very heavily staffed with lawyers. All the divisions have their own chief counsel's offices, so we're not talking about the entire legal staff of the SEC by any means.
The number of folks in the office went up to roughly 120 when Congress and the administration increased the budget after 2002. And the agency as a whole grew a great deal, and there were additional staff added in the general counsel's office to help with some of the new responsibilities that were added by that.
If we were to imagine an organizational chart here of the SEC, where would the general counsel's office appear on that chart?
If one looks at the org chart, there are a series of direct reports to the chairman and commissioners, and those include the heads of the divisions, and they also include the general counsel. And so the general counsel's office on that organization chart would be located in a line that reports through the general counsel to the chairman and the commissioners, and at the same level as the division directors. Indeed, as you may know, under one of the organic statutes that governs the administration of the commission, reorganization Plan 10 of 1950. The chairman is authorized to direct the staff and appoint the staff without the consent of the commission in general, except for the heads of major administrative organizational units within the agency, and the division directors and the general counsel have traditionally been viewed among those that would require the sign-off of the other commissioners. So it's at that level.
You've given us some notion of the breadth of activities in the office. Do you think it's possible to describe its mission in 25 words or less, 50 words or less?
Well, in, I don't know what it would be, five or six, I guess you'd say the general counsel is the chief legal officer of the commission, but maybe we ought to go into the laundry list of some of the sorts of things that fall under that.
Please do.
Heading, it's a long list.
I mean, another way to think about it, to pick up on Dan's comment, is you can think about the general counsel's office as the commission's law firm. Because, and I choose those words carefully because, on the one hand, it reflects the, an important element of the office, which is the office works for the commission. And that comes up in multiple ways because many times, because it's a significant organization in terms of size, not every division of the commission sees all the different moving parts or views what it's doing in light of all the different things that the agency is doing. So part of what the general counsel's office brings as the commission's law firm is a legal perspective that cuts across division and office lines. The other element of being the commission's law firm is that part of the commission's job is to test what's going on in the divisions, to offer their own perspective, and to sort of see opposing perspectives that the rest of the world might see. And part of the general counsel's office job, again, as the commission's law firm, is to help develop that perspective of a counterpoint, in a sense, to some of the other things that various folks on the staff are doing. It's also the commission's law firm in the sense that when a legal problem comes in and there's no one who's assigned to take care of it, it goes to the general counsel's office, and that can be everything from negotiating the lease for the new building to, you know, litigation that's designed to preempt an enforcement action.
One thing I've always been a bit curious about is the exact relationship between the general counsel and the SEC solicitor. Could you perhaps help me out with that a bit?
Well, I think that's something that's changed over time, too. If I remember correctly, when I arrived in 1974, there was no solicitor, although if you look back at older documents, that title had apparently been used at various times during the 30s, 40s, 50s. I think the sort of what is in effect the current position of solicitor was created in the mid or late 70s, essentially for Dave Ferber, who had been running the office's appellate litigation for many years, and the commission wanted to, I think, sort of recognize his service and to at least a limited degree his independence in the area of appellate litigation by creating this new title of solicitor. But even then, and I'm quite sure continuing to today, the solicitor was part of the general counsel's office, at least for administrative purposes, reported to the general counsel. And I think whatever the sort of the yin and yang between the two has been in the past, I think it would be pretty clear today that the general counsel is the head of the office and is also the the supervisor, if you will, of the solicitor and the appellate work under the solicitor's jurisdiction.
And to pick up on that, going back to Dan's point about the organizational structure of the office, within the general counsel's office, there are five components, one of which is the appellate group, and that is headed by the solicitor and is responsible for all appellate matters that the commission is involved in. There's also the what's known sometimes as counseling, but really has a broader mandate to provide advice on legal policy to the staff and the commission, legal policy group, and which is also responsible for reviewing enforcement actions. Then there's the what's known as adjudication, which was previously the Office of, I think, Opinions and Review it was called at one time or something like that, that writes the commission's opinions in adjudicatory appeals. then fourth major unit in terms of the number of people is the general litigation and administrative unit that handles any actions against the commission, defending commission employees when they're witnesses, lease-type matters, personnel matters, et cetera, as well as attorney misconduct issues now. And then the final group, which is small in numbers but important in its role, is the Office of Ethics, with the Chief Ethics Officer also reporting to the General Counsel. So that kind of picks up on the role of the solicitor and where it fits into this office and its structure.
And all of this, we may get into this later in our chat, but all of this has evolved and changed a lot over the years. I mean, again, from a perspective of my arrival in 1974, the office was then doing almost exclusively appellate litigation. The counseling function didn't exist, I mean, except in an informal sense that the commission might seek advice from time to time, you know, about particular non-litigation matters from the office. The title of solicitor didn't exist. Ethics wasn't a separately broken out function. Opinions and review was a separate office in the commission. Adjudication wasn't part of the office's work. There's really, I think if you look over the last 30 years or so, there's been a expansion and consolidation of some functions that were independent into the office.
You mentioned that, this is to pick up again on something you said earlier, which is that we can think of the Office of the General Counsel as the commission's law firm. And that leads me to ask the question, how do you go about conceptualizing your client in that circumstance? Is it the five commissioners acting as a single body? Is it the entire organization? What is the real client there?
Well, I mean, this is a big subject. I guess it seems to me that technically it's the agency whose will or position is determined by a majority vote of the five commissioners. Commissioners presumably base their votes on, you know, what they think is in the public interest as defined in the securities laws. Certainly in practice, and again, this is probably something we'll discuss, but in practice, general counsels tend to have a close relationship with the chairman, and so sometimes that produces some tension. But I wouldn't say that the chairman is the general counsel's client, as distinguished from the agency itself. You raised the possibility of the American people being the client of the general counsel, which isn't a concept I'd really quite thought of before. I mean, again, I suppose the people come in through the commissioners making their determination about how the securities laws should be enforced.
I agree with that. I mean, I think on the point of the American people, if you walked into court and said, I'm here on behalf of the United States of America, I think that the Justice Department would be pretty unhappy about that. I think, indeed, there are many areas where there are disagreements between the commission's lawyers and Justice Department. We see that in antitrust cases. They get sorted out at the highest levels when it goes to the Supreme Court or something. Within the agency, obviously, the issue, I think, is just the way Dan poses it. The client is the commission. What is, of course, true with that kind of organizational client, like any kind, is that there are mechanisms by which the client administers its affairs that the general counsel respects. On matters like rulemaking or other matters, you know, where you're having an approval of an enforcement action or something, the commissioners vote and the general counsel's office is active in supporting the decision that was taken by the commission by a majority as appropriate. There are a number of matters that I alluded to earlier that are committed by law to the chairman to make decisions on without reference to having votes. And in those contexts, of course, one works with the chairman because the chairman is ultimately, by law, the boss of all the people who work in the agency in terms of the administration of the commission and the executions of its function. So your client is the commission, but your boss is the chairman. Is one way to think about it. And occasionally that can present issues, but it depends very much on the human beings involved at that point. You try never to let things get to a point. Indeed, one of the main things that general counsels do is to try to avoid ever getting in the position where the views of the commission and the views of the chairman are so at odds that it's really a problem figuring out who your client is.
That makes a lot of sense. Suppose, as a strictly hypothetical matter, that on one of the with respect to one of the matters that's dedicated to the chairman by virtue of the law. The general counsel felt that said chairman was doing something that was completely wrongheaded, completely perhaps against the law. Where would the general counsel go in that circumstance?
I think that's the same problem that any lawyer who works inside an organization faces if they find their, the leader of their organization wanting to take an action that's illegal. Obviously, as a lawyer, you can't allow that to occur. The range of options is all pretty much a menu of unappealing things that one could do, ranging from resigning, from trying to seek inquiries by the inspector general, by enlisting assistance of other people on the staff to raise issues. That they're an unappealing menu. I think, by and large, we've been fortunate in that I don't think that the chairman of the commission have been people who, when push came to shove, would do something that their general counsel thought was illegal.
And I suppose it's not an issue that's unique to the chairman. You could have a situation, I suppose, where the general counsel felt that the commission majority wanted to do something that was illegal. I agree that you're then confronted with what what Giovanni called a menu of unattractive choices. I would say we had, at a sort of lower level, we had occasional situations where people in the office wouldn't work on a particular matter because they thought that the position the commission was taking was wrong. And unfortunately, those weren't very common, but that did occur occasionally, and we simply accommodated those people when that happened.
You said it was the same issue that would confront anyone representing an organization. Do you think that it is exactly the same as representing an agency, more or less challenging than representing your garden variety organization, do you think?
My sense is that representing, being a lawyer inside a government agency does have significant differences in the way it plays out compared to a private company. One of the most visible things, of course, is the very visibility of everything one does in the government. There isn't a working assumption that I think you have to have as a lawyer in the government that there may be attorney-client privilege, it's not very meaningful as to Congress. All of your advice, everything you say, may well end up being produced at some congressional hearing someday. That can happen to anyone, I understand. But it's a much more public way of practicing law when you're inside the agency, especially in times when the agency's mission is important to the public interest. I think that there are also challenges that come from being inside an agency in terms of motivation, because there aren't the same ability. One doesn't have the same tools to incent people, either on the positive side by lots of financial incentives, or on the negative side by having them go away and find other work, at least with near the same ease as in the private sector. And that can present some challenges when people aren't all on board with the mission, as Dan was describing.
Yeah, I mean, I think just sort of generally thinking about representing organizations, I think there are always challenges coming from the fact that the organization may be your client, but you're dealing with individuals that can only communicate with you through people that you have a personal relationship with. I mean, thinking in the maybe more in the corporate setting than in the governmental setting, there's a strong, I think, human tendency to want to please the people that you're working for and have them feel that you're doing a good job in promoting their interests. And I guess in the corporate setting, occasionally, you may have to stop and think about whether the management that you're dealing with is diverging from the interests of the shareholders, their fiduciary duties to the corporation, or with compliance with the law, which is, I think, something Giovanni could speak about at length because he worked on the rules coming out of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act that deal with that. But in a sense, I think it's easier working for a government agency like the commission, because there's a defined process to make a decision. I mean, if a majority of the commissioners say, this is our position, nobody else can really come in and say, well, you're breaching your duty to the American public or to the shareholders. You may win or lose in court if it's a position you're going to be taking in court, but there's no real collateral way of challenging the rightness or propriety of that decision.
Would you say that what the SEC's general counsel's office does is, now earlier you mentioned that they might engage in more different kinds of activities than the general counsel of certain other agencies, but are the basic challenges, the basic dynamics of representing an agency similar across the board, do you think, or is the SEC somehow a unique situation?
I think there are an awful lot of similarities, but one thing I would emphasize in terms of potentially an area where, again, it's a matter of degree, there's a difference that I perceived at the SEC from some other agencies, is, and it's something Dan alluded to earlier. I think that the SEC has preserved its tradition of independence from whoever the administration may be and from whoever may be controlling Congress to a greater extent than some other agencies. Everyone in government has to be responsive to someone that's appropriate, and that is the system we have and we want. But there are times when there are external forces that would like to influence the decisions of a regulatory agency, whether it's the SEC or others. And for, again, I think historical reasons, some hard-fought battles by predecessors of ours, and continuing hard-fought battles that people go through all the time, the agency has been better at saying to Congress, to the administration, you know, we do this here. We're an independent agency. We know this. We are, of course, happy to listen to any thoughtful views on any issue in public. That, as it always worked at the SEC, it's not perfect. We know that. But I think it has had a – and my perception was that we had a higher degree of independence than many other agencies.
And I think that's really an important point. In fact, it's one of the defining characteristics of the Office of the General Counsel at the SEC and perhaps in a way of the SEC itself, that is the independence that they've been able to maintain from the administration and from other kinds of sort of intergovernmental pressures. Like, I mean, I guess apart from that, I would say that I don't think the challenges are sort of conceptually different than they would be at any other, at least any other multi-headed agency.
Presumably with the independence comes responsibility, and I'm interested in how the General Counsel's office goes about recruiting to satisfy its obligations. What do you look for in the perfect recruit?
I think that people look for the same things they look for in any lawyer that they're trying to recruit: intelligence, commitment, judgment, and an interest in the work of the agency that they would be doing. I think that the agency's been fortunate over the years to have a strong tradition that it has fed on itself of attracting very bright people, both out of law school and later in their careers after they've dabbled in private practice or in other jobs, and has tried to maintain some pretty high intellectual standards and academic standards on top of maintaining a work environment that is, I think, very collegial and that is very mission-oriented. The agency still is a place that I think, by and large, people believe in its mission. And I'm not sure that's true in every government agency or organization. So you try to find folks who will have the set of characteristics that will leave the agency in as good or better a place for the next generation as it was left to, you know, to them.
I mean, one of the surprises of the young part of my career was that the day I went to interview at the SEC, the first thing they did in the general counsel's office was make me take a written test. I don't know whether they still administer that written test or not, but it was quite a tradition in the office, although I must say I hadn't heard about it until the day I had to take it. But the idea was to give people a problem sort of comparable to an issue that you would address in an appellate brief. You were given the law. Yeah, I mean, it didn't call for any substantive knowledge of the law, but then you were supposed to write a little, I don't know, essay or like a section of an appellate brief. And then as you interviewed with people, you had to take your paper around with you and they would all read it and then quiz you on the subject. So I guess that was a reflection of the kind of people that
that the office was trying to recruit people with writing ability, I suppose, particularly, and the kinds of skills that would lead to making good appellate lawyers, because, again, in that day, that was the main thing that was being sought. I would say, too, and I guess this has been true largely throughout the years, that it was fairly uncommon in those days to recruit anyone straight out of law school, and most people had a couple years private practice experience and gotten some training and a little knowledge of the securities laws in that context, and then were looking either for a, sort of a change in perspective, a change in lifestyle, or whatever the resume burnishing effects might be of some period of service on the SEC staff.
I was going to ask what sort of training might be provided to your younger hires. That is, obviously, people who come in with more experience will require less training, but is there a formal period of training or a formal program?
Well, picking up on Dan's point, while some lawyers do come in right out of law school, it's still a minority, I think, in the general counsel's office. There are usually people have had a few years of experience, typically at a law firm. So some of the basic elements of practicing law they've picked up there. But the training tends to be highly focused on the job type training and the traditional way that lawyers have been trained. There are programs that people go to. There's more technology to support training than there was even probably 10 years ago. And so there's a commitment to doing that. And in addition, the agency's been successful in recruiting some good folks out of law school who do want to go right into public service and has tried to think about how to make that work more effectively. One of the good things about the general counsel's office is that the ratio of supervisors to younger lawyers is actually much more favorable than it is in the rest of the commission, so that you will have a supervisor who typically will have only three or four people working for them, whereas in the rest of the agency it's probably going to be twice that ratio. And when you combine that with the absolute wealth of expertise in terms of human beings that exist in the agency, the reliance on human resources makes a lot of sense, because you see this when you leave at the agency, there are always at least one or two people who are among the leading experts on any section of the securities laws that you want to pick, who you can go and speak with and will have a wealth of history and knowledge. There are also people who have just a long tradition at the level of the way they do the work in terms of writing appellate briefs, arguing appellate cases. So you're really learning from people who are at the highest level of experience and expertise throughout your time there. So I think it's a good training environment.
Yeah, I mean, in thinking about this question, I mean, I think my reaction was that the work is the training. It's probably the best postgraduate course you can get in the federal securities laws. I'm, again, certainly thinking of my own time there. I think it was commonly said, and I certainly believe, that you couldn't get better training in appellate advocacy and writing an appellate brief than working with Dave Ferber on writing a brief, if you survived the experience. And Dave was not an easy person to work with, but you always learned a lot, and you certainly perfected your writing skills. And if you didn't, he would let you know in the most forceful way that you had. But I think other than perhaps going to the Solicitor General's office at the Justice Department, I think the General Counsel's office at the SEC is the best way there is to learn to become an appellate lawyer.
Speaking of sharpening skills, I'd like to go to the issue of sort of basic skills, the ones that recent graduates bring to the table. This is an aside, but it's one that I'm particularly interested in. Do you think that law schools are turning out the right lawyers for jobs like service in the Office of General Counsel? Here I'm asking both about a basic skill set of research, analytic and writing ability, and about ethical sensitivity.
I'll jump in on this. I think the answer is yes and no, in the sense that I think, yes, law schools are producing people that have a right basic skill set in terms of the core things that law schools can teach people, which are about writing, analyzing problems, cases, statutes, thinking about how to read in the law, trying to have some sensitivity to the broader public policy issues. But I think the answer is no on the other side, in the sense that there are a lot of things that one does as a lawyer, including at the SEC, that are not readily taught in law schools. And those include not only a variety of human elements, people dynamics, the mechanics of, and one of the joys of the law is that it ranges from the sublime to the mundane. You not only have to write a beautiful brief, you have to make sure it's got the right color, you know, cover on it, and that it arrives at the right courthouse at the right time on the right day. It's that kind of work. And so there's a real mixture there. In addition, a place like the SEC, there's a lot of specialized knowledge that we were just talking about. And no law school is likely to turn out folks who have that high degree of specialized securities knowledge. But that's okay, because you can learn that at the SEC.
Yeah, my reaction is pretty much the same. I think both at the SEC and I think of my time in private practice, also, I guess in a sense, we weren't really expecting much more of the new law school graduates than that they had sort of the basic knowledge of how to do legal research and, you know, sort of a basic grounding in what the law consisted of. But most of the learning would be on the job, and the work of lawyers, both at the SEC and more generally, is so vast and varied, you can't really expect a law school to be training people for particular kinds of things they're likely to end up in private practice or at the SEC. I guess I would say, too, in the general counsel's office, they had fairly high standards of who would be hired, so we weren't perhaps seeing the sort of the average run of law students. We were school graduates. We were seeing more the cream of the crop.
When you speak of vast and varied, I take it that you mean not just the collected tasks of the entire office, but also the discrete things that an individual lawyer might be called on to do. If there is anything like an ordinary day in the life of a lawyer in the general counsel's office, could you describe it? For instance, how many things might he or she be working on at one time, or how would he or she spend their day?
Well, it seems to me that you can't really give a single answer to that, because it's going to depend what part of the office the person is working in. For example, if you're working on an appellate brief, you might well devote all day for a week, 2 weeks, maybe longer than that, researching and writing that brief. On the other hand, the folks, for example, in the counseling group that are dealing with what's on the commission's calendar, they may well have to look at, six, five, ten, whatever the number might be of issues in the course of a day. So it's going to vary widely, I would say.
I think that you've already indicated that the job of the commission, the job of the office has changed over time, that various functions have been added particularly. I would expect, too, that if the job of the commission changes, the job of its lawyer's office is also going to change. In your view, has the job of the commission itself changed over time?
Well, I suppose it depends what you mean by job. I mean, the basic job of investor protection through a largely disclosure-based regime hasn't changed, and I think that's really one of the things that's been the strength of the commission, that it's had that fairly clear mission. On the other hand, I think one of the fun things about being there is that if you begin to list the issues that are important at any particular time, and then to list them over time, it's almost endless. When I was there, certainly law of insider trading was a major issue. Regulation of hostile takeovers was a major issue. Relationship between the SEC and the CFTC were issues. I guess I could go on and on. Many of those issues still exist in the same form today, but on the other hand, they've changed, and the things that people have to deal with in the office and at the commission generally have changed as the underlying markets change.
Picking up on that thought, if you think about how dynamic the financial markets are in the United States and now globally, the mission has to evolve as those markets evolve. And one of the things I think that, for me, always interesting is, because change seems to be coming faster and faster, market time is increasingly getting short. The commission has adapted many of its mechanisms, if you think about shelf registration, to help move those things along at various times. At some point, though, the agency has to work on due process time. when it does rulemakings, adjudications, and litigation. And whether there's a real tension that has to be resolved as to how you reconcile those two different time frames, I think that's especially true as we look at what's happening in the cross-border context today, the different style of regulation in other countries. I think the current commission is very aware of that and has embraced that as an issue to try to think through. But again, as Dan says, it's not that this is the first time the commission's faced challenges. It's just this epoch has its own.
Indeed.
Just before we leave the subject of change completely, I would just say, kind of from my perspective, a radical change in the office occurred in probably 1978, 1979, somewhere in that time frame when the counseling group in the office was created. Because prior to that, really the center of gravity of the office's work was litigation and largely appellate litigation. And then for reasons that Giovanni touched on earlier, there was a desire by particularly Chairman Williams and Chairman Shadd to sort of hear both sides of many issues, not just the perspective of the division that was making recommendations to the commission. The counseling group was created, which is now a quite substantial unit in the office, to take an active role in reviewing really everything on the commission's calendar, and to some extent to be sort of a legal policy arm for the chairman and for the commission. I think, you know, today counseling is certainly very key in what the office does, and not to diminish the appellate and district court litigation and the other things the office is also involved in.
I'm going to pose a few questions for both of you to answer in turn here. Dan, what would you say was your biggest frustration as general counsel?
Well, I've been thinking about that. I'm not sure if frustration is quite the right word. I guess I felt we had some difficult times occasionally with congressional oversight and the relationship with the oversight committees in Congress. During a lot of the time that I was general counsel, the presidency was in one hands and the House was in other hands, the Senate kind of swaying back and forth. And we had some exciting times at congressional hearings. I mean, I wonder, remember one incident particularly where SEC had come up with the idea of EDGAR, which is now the electronic filing system that's quite familiar to people. And John Shadd, kind of consistent with his philosophy, wanted it to be self-funded by users, which would have meant it was outside the appropriations process, and this didn't sit too well. So we attended one hearing where a congressman held up a sign that said EDGAR on it. And he said, this is supposed to be the electronic data gathering analysis and retrieval system. It can't retrieve data, and he tore off the R. It can't analyze data, tore off the A. It can't gather data, tore off the G. And then he folded out the word Mr. in front of it. So the sign now said Mr. Ed. And the SEC has as much chance of ever developing this system as it does of finding a talking horse. So that, to me, that kind of summarized some of our relationships with Congress in those days.
Truly memorable. Giovanni, same question.
I don't have anything specific that's so memorable. For me, I think if one phrases it as a frustration, I think it partly is the flip side of the mission that we're talking about, insofar as the mission of the General Counsel's Office is to provide this broader perspective. Occasionally, more than occasionally, it can be frustrating trying to get the different parts of the agency to all see a shared mission. And when I say that, I include the commissioners, who themselves sometimes have particular views that reflect interests and legitimate ones, but that don't always, I think, see that they are actually role models for all the staff that take away a lot of their perspective from that. And so occasionally getting everyone on the same page when, after all, everyone really, in theory, is working for the same people here in the same entity is probably the part of it that, especially having come from outside, is a little frustrating. But I think it is part of the job of the GC, so it's a probably natural and good frustration to have.
Looking at perhaps the opposite side of things, Dan, what was your fondest achievement as general counsel?
Well, I mean, again, that's a hard question to answer. I think we accomplished some important things in tender offer regulation and earlier days before I was general counsel in the area of corrupt payments and the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. I guess I could go on with a long list. But the thing I really remember the most fondly is those calendar review meetings we had every Monday morning where we basically get the entire office together, talk about every item that was going to be on the commission's calendar in the coming week, and what perhaps we could say about it to give a little different perspective on what the division wanted to do. I enjoyed those things immensely, and I still today have people who were staff attorneys in those days come up to me and say how sort of what a meaningful professional development experience it was for them to be involved in those dialogues and then to present a different view to the commission.
I can see why.
There are a lot of fantastic things, and calendar meetings are really up there. Another similar kind of thing like that is when you're looking at an amicus brief and you have the parties come in from both sides and talk to you, and then they leave the room and you say to the folks, okay, what do we think the right thing to do is? And as a lawyer, you so rarely get to have those experiences where in an informed way your job is to figure out the right thing. In terms of achievements, I think for me, because I was there during Sarbanes-Oxley, it's hard not to focus in on the effort that went into that. The statute was enacted, as you know, in July at the end of the month, and Congress wrote a series of very tight deadlines into that statute for rulemaking to be done by the agency, most of which had to be done within 6 months. And my tasks included making sure we got all of those rules done on time. I was confident they'd be under budget because we didn't have any more money than we had. The great thing was there, sort of the other side of what we were just talking about in terms of tensions, I think people really pulled together knowing how difficult the challenge was, knowing how important it was for the agency to take this on, even though there were some very significant policy divisions. And amazingly, and people, I think, don't always focus on this, the commission adopted every one of those Sarbanes-Oxley rules on time, met all of the deadlines for both proposing and adopting to the extent there were both, and every vote by the commission on those was unanimous. There were some other things that happened during that time period that were divisive, but I think that ability of the agency to come together and to be part of that exercise with, our time and responsibility chart and everybody's home phone number on the back and our weekly Tuesday meetings and so forth was a particularly interesting and fond moment for me.
That was quite an achievement. I remember talking to other outsiders, looking in, rolling our eyes and saying, they can't possibly get it done that fast, but you did. Now, for what I think it's a different question, although maybe it will turn out to be exactly the same one. What was the most interesting thing you remember working on?
Well, I mean, for me, there's certainly a lot of things that could come under that heading. I guess I would say being part of the evolution of the law of insider trading was probably the most interesting. Shortly after I became general counsel, we lost the Dirks case in the Supreme Court, which put to rest the idea that insider trading depended on equal access or unequal access to information. And so over the period I was general counsel was rife with hostile takeovers, which are fertile ground for insider trading. So it's a very active, insider trading is a very active program in the enforcement division. We worked with the division and then in the appellate courts in developing the misappropriation theory, fleshing out concepts of personal benefit and tipping cases, and just other things that really hadn't been part of the law until the Dirks case, and then eventually, just after I was gone from the office, and in O'Hagan, the Supreme Court ratified misappropriation, and that law has now become relatively settled compared to what it was in the early 80s.
I think that the amicus program and the appellate program probably as a whole offered the most interesting intellectual pieces of the job for me in a lot of ways as well, in that the we made an effort to try to expand the amicus program a bit, to reinvigorate it, draw people's attention to it. In addition, we had several Supreme Court cases on really interesting and important topics, as well as cases throughout the appellate courts. And I think for lawyers who enjoy legal work, that kind of work is just always fascinating. And we did, I think, have a chance to make contribution on some important issues, ranging from the definition of security to loss causation. You know. But I wouldn't, in thinking about it from a big picture level, I wouldn't forget that in some ways many of the most interesting things that happen are not big picture things, but small things that just to sort of one day we had an unexpected issue come up in the enforcement context, and the division decided they wanted to have the commission meet immediately to authorize a case. It was so unexpected that the closed commission meeting room was being used for an international kind of conclave, so we couldn't really throw out all these people from foreign securities regulators. So we took the biggest conference room we could find, which was the Enforcement Division's conference room, set it up with the microphones. I don't even think we had all the commissioners, but we had a quorum. And we started talking about this case, and the head of the Enforcement Division started to lay it out. And at a certain point, the chairman, smart person, said, well, what's the legal theory on that? The head of the Division of Enforcement, also a smart person, said, well, Giovanni, what is the legal theory on that? But, you know, it was a great discussion, and I think we ended up in the right place. And it's those kind of moments where you're really at the table working, you know, together with all these folks developing, you know, theories that fit the facts and that are trying to serve the public. That kind of thing is just fascinating.
We're getting close to our limit on time, but we've talked already today about the achievements and contributions of Eric Sommergrad. Are there any other folks that each of you may have worked with that you particularly like to reminisce about for a moment?
Well, I hate this kind of question because there's just, once you start naming people, there's so many people that should be named. I probably shouldn't mention any. I guess I would say that both Harvey Pitt and Ralph Farrar were kind of role models to me because they followed the same course through the commission, starting as staff attorneys and eventually becoming general counsel. I think, however, that probably the person that to me has most defined the general counsel's office over the last, I don't know, 30-plus years would be Paul Gonson, was solicitor, deputy general counsel. Paul, I certainly always knew that when I needed advice, I could go to Paul and get it. And on more than one occasion, he restrained me from some of my wilder and more ill-advised ideas. He's a first-rate lawyer, a terrific gentleman, and you couldn't imagine a better colleague.
I, like Dan, I feel that if I started to name people, it would go on forever. But I will add in the Paul Gonson tradition, Jake Stillman, who's now been at the agency for, I think, getting on 45 years in the appellate group, who I think is built on the tradition that Paul had and is just a true public servant of the highest level in every sense.
I'd like to add my concurrence on Jake.
Dan and Giovanni, thank you for your insightful comments and perspectives on the SEC Office of the General Counsel's work over the past nearly 75 years. Again, I'd like to thank the family of Eric Sommergrad for making this program possible as a memorial to his work for and legacy within the SEC. Eric was quite modest about his many contributions to the work of the Office of the General Counsel. I'll quote from a letter he wrote in response to Milton Freeman's missive, from which I read at the beginning of this broadcast. While we were working on O'Hagan, I told the folks here that they should defer to me, since I was the only one among them who had actually won an insider trading case in the Supreme Court. Fortunately, I was not taken seriously, and the end product, of course, was the result of a collaborative effort among the highly talented lawyers at the Commission. Today's fireside chat is now archived in audio format in the virtual museum, so you can listen again to the discussion at any time. A transcript of the discussion, as well as the audio in MP3 format, will be accessioned in the online programs section in the coming months. The memorial information on Eric Sommergrad, currently under News and Events, will be linked with this fireside chat in online programs beginning in April. Please join us again next month on April 22nd at 3 p.m. Eastern Daylight Savings Time for our next fireside chat. this time discussing the work of the SEC Office of International Affairs, one of the newer major offices of the SEC. My guests will be Michael Mann, who helped found the office, and Dr. Felice Batlin, who is curating the museum's gallery on the SEC and International Securities Regulation, which will open later this year. Thank you again for being with us today.